Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you from the mountains of Utah, where the days are getting shorter and the nights colder. A quick note for those of you who don't follow me on social media. A few weeks ago, I ended up in the hospital with an extreme arrhythmia caused by a previously unknown birth defect. I had minor heart surgery, and I am now mostly recovered. While I was in the hospital, my brother Sam died of complications with his own surgery. So it's been a rough month. My consistency may be a bit worse than usual over the winter. Hopefully not. I don't have a lot more to say about it right now. Maybe in the future. On a lighter note, I still plan on being at Brandon Sanderson's Dragonsteel Con in Salt Lake City on November 14th and 15th. I'll have books and swag to sell and be available to chat at my own booth. Hope to see some of you there. Now on with the show. My guest this week is writer, artist, and illustrator Ursula Vernon. Ursula and I talk about gardening, Ursula's love of anthropomorphic animals, and writing the books we want to read. We discuss just how weird early science fiction and fantasy could be, and what happens when a beloved series goes off the rails. We also dig into the business side of what we do, travel, making money, and the complications of printing and self-publishing. Enjoy my conversation with Ursula Vernon. Well, hey, Ursula, thanks for joining me today.
Delighted to be here.
I was hoping that we could start by you telling me a little bit about your garden.
Oh, goodness. It's at the moment it has kind of gotten away from me because it's that time of year when it's just too damn hot to go outside and work in it much. So I go out, I harvest tomatoes and cucumbers, I shake my fist at the weeds, I go back inside. But most of the time, I spend a lot of time out there in spring and fall. I will write out there. I love it. It's probably like my major hobby, other than, you know, writing books, which is sort of my job, I guess.
Right. No, that's rad. I'm always jealous of people who can write outside, because I've tried writing outside before. And I always feel like there is something tiny annoying me, whether it's a little tiny gnat buzzing around in my screen or whether it's a glare that makes it so I can't see my screen. It just bugs the crap out of me.
Yeah, in autumn, it's a lot harder because the mosquitoes are out. There's this glorious period in spring before the mosquitoes hit when it's lovely. And then, you know, and I can douse myself with DEET, but DEET strips paint. So it wears the letters off my keyboard if I DEET up and try to type. So, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in Ohio, which has really bad mosquitoes. I grew up right up near the lake. And man, I live in a high desert in Utah now, and we barely get mosquitoes. And that's like the biggest change I love.
Oh, man, I envy that. Yeah, I lived in Minnesota for quite a while, and we had lots of mosquitoes there, and it was lovely when I lived in Arizona and Phoenix. We had very little in the mosquito department. Now I live in North Carolina, which is a swamp. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, that can be a bit overwhelming, because when you're like, one of the things I love about out east is it's so green all the time.
Oh yeah,
and I love the greenery. I love being out in the greenery, but gosh, the mosquitoes! The moment the sun starts going down, those things just strip the skin from me.
Oh yeah, the worst place I've ever been for that is actually the Gulf Coast of Texas. High Island, Texas is right on the Gulf. And they had the kind of mosquitoes that would, you know, treated 90% DEET as a garnish and would take your blood, then your car keys kind of things. They were dire. But it's bugs, man. Bugs.
Right. See, I grew up with my parents, like, they really liked the idea of, like, the whole kind of having your kids learn to homestead thing. And so we had a massive garden, and I hated that garden so much. Like, going out in the middle of the summer to try to weed the stupid thing.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, trying to weed, like my dad, oh, I'm going to teach you how to thin corn. Yeah, Dad, there's video games to play. Like, I have friends doing fun things. Why would I do this on Saturday?
Oh, yeah. It is a labor of love, and if you don't love it, then it's basically just really hard work. And all the people who are like, you can totally feed yourself out of the garden, like, how many children do you have doing unpaid labor to pull that off?
Oh, that was definitely how it was when I was growing up. I was the youngest of six, and so we had one of those big old chest freezers that we would fill with, you know, we would harvest a bunch of corn and cut it off the cob and freeze it for all winter and all that stuff. And oh man, like I appreciate it much more as an adult. Like I have my little garden, I putter around on it. I love my raspberries and I know how to do all this stuff. But also, like, when you're an adult, you have the choice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if I want to be like, oh, I'm not gardening this summer, I'll do it next year, I can do that. But when you're a kid, you don't get that option.
Yeah, and there are parts of the year when I'm just like, no, it is not worth it to garden here. And vegetables that I will not try to grow. Like, I don't have the space for corn. I don't bother with squash or pumpkins or anything like that. Because it's like, if it touches the ground, the bugs get it. And yeah, there's a lot to be said for puttering as opposed to subsistence.
right. There's a big difference there. So you are very well known for your love of anthropomorphic animals, for your comics and your writing. And I was kind of curious, where did that come from?
I'm not sure. I grew up loving talking animals. I read Watership Down and at, like, you know, I don't know, seven, and was like, this is the greatest book that has ever existed in the history of the world.
You mean the trauma didn't destroy you at that age?
Oh, no. I was the one. I always wanted to check the movie out, you know, and the movie is yeah, like, how many people were traumatized by General Woundwort with the froth and the drool and the blood? And no, I wanted to watch it every single week. My parents were eventually like, can we please just anything else, please? and read the book God knows how many times. And these days, if I had wanted to read, you know, dozens of talking animal books as a kid, they have them. They've got, you know, Warriors about cats and Guardians about owls and God knows what else. In the early 80s, we did not have that. We had Watership Down and Wind in the Willows, and that was about it. You could read the Black Beauty or the Black Stallion books, which are not talking animals and also get really weird towards the end. You could tell when they were just handing Walter Farley money and being like, your contract says you'll write another book. And he's like, fine, this one's about aliens that are really into horse racing for some reason. And yeah. So part of why I got into writing was that there were no more books of the kind that I really wanted to read. So I had to write them. And there was Narnia. Narnia was the other big one. So, yeah.
I don't actually remember when it came out. But for me, I guess it probably was Redwall.
Yes. Redwall is awesome. But it was way after that, sadly.
I mean, I loved those. And I loved Watership Down. I loved, I only read one of the first, the Black Stallion. I didn't even know there were sequels.
Oh God, there's like 30 or 40 of them. Yeah.
Really?
Yes. And they start out as like, okay, you know, Black Stallion. Okay. And then eventually, you know, he wins a race and then there's another thing and he wins another race. Okay, great. All right. Now he has his son and okay. So the Black Stallion's son will race and we can get a couple books out of that. And then, okay, maybe this other horse we can get a few books out of. And we are running out of the plot ability of horse racing. So Aliens, yeah. Vampire bats, yeah. Shipwreck, okay. Voodoo, sure, why not? Ghosts, let's do it. And it, like, ends with the apocalypse, and the Black Stallion is apparently actually the incarnation of the Horsehead Nebula or something. And then it's Armageddon. The phone, you know, dude is trying to call his family, and the line goes dead, and that's the end of the book. And I'm like, you did not want to write another book. You were just like, I am done with this series forever.
That is so weird.
It's a, it is so surreal. Yes.
Oh, man.
I should have asked, swearing on this podcast, is that okay?
Yeah, it's totally fine.
Okay.
Oh, man, that's so bizarre. There are times when I forget how incredibly weird some of the books were that I read as a kid. Because when you read something as a kid, you just kind of accept it.
It's normal that this must be what books are like.
Yeah, that's such a bizarre phenomenon. I don't really think about that often, because like when I'm writing, like I try to keep so strict in terms of the rules of the universe that I've created, and trying to stay within those rules and write something very approachable to new readers, all that stuff. And it didn't used to be like that. It used to be so much of just you throwing crap on the page just to see what people liked.
Yeah, I think it's even worse for kids' books, because there's a very whatever you can get away with, and okay, it can be fantastical or bizarre and no one cares that much as long as it looks cool. I mean, like James and the Giant Peach. Like, what kind of a pitch is that? There's a giant mutant peach and a bunch of talking insects, and they sail around in a giant peach carried by seagulls. A book I had as a kid from, like, I think it was from, like, 1914 or something, The Wonderful Electric Elephant. And I had this because there were old books in the house, and this was one that was for kids. And it's the story of this guy who encounters a mechanical elephant that you can ride around in. And so he rides around the world having adventures. And it's 1914, so it's all like bizarre and racist and just, but it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And then the elephant can fly. And then they're like, okay, let's use the elephant to stampede into, you know, the Forbidden City in China and kill a bunch of people. And you're like, wait, what is going on here? Or the Swiss Family Robinson, which is deeply messed up, and I read like 800 times.
I loved that book as a kid.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the book and the movie, I rewatched that movie until it wore out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I did a live tweet of rereading it a while back, and that book is... Like, it's not even how improbable the animals are. Everything is just so improbable. You're just like, okay. And you snuck up on the iguana by whistling to it. And you hypnotized the iguana, and then you stabbed it through the nose. Okay, yeah, sure, why not? It goes on like that for ages. Okay, we tamed a penguin by tying it to a flamingo. And I'm like, I'm just about certain that is not how you tame a penguin. I just gonna go out on a limb. So yeah.
Right. I remember when I was, I don't know, probably 13 or 14, somebody gifted me like the collected works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh yeah.
And I decided I was going to read it from beginning to end. And the thing is that we're already familiar with Edgar Allan Poe being super weird, right? Like from all his famous stuff, his less famous stuff is even weirder. There's his I think it might be his longest work is like it's a very long novella. I think that it's like all about this crazy adventure in like the South Atlantic or something like that. It's
the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just ends like abruptly with the guy like rowing into like a fog bank.
Yeah. It's I had one of those collections too, and I think they were like very, very trendy. The you know, the complete works of Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Mark Twain, and you know, they had the handsome sort of leather bound things that you would give them to kids who read too much for Christmas. And some of them I'm like, okay, yeah, Poe, this is fine, it's fine. Others I'm like, okay, this was your attempt at humor. You're not great at it. I'm still reading it, but huh.
Right. Some of that stuff can get so strange. Like, and it's weird because we think, like, modern day, you know, like, we feel like maybe we're, like, kind of used to strange because we watch so many superhero movies and we've got all these bizarre things that are in the media now, in pop culture, that we just take as, oh, this is fun. This is what we watch and enjoy. And you can look backwards and be like, wow, those people were even weirder than we were.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. We are not as avant-garde, I think, as we think we are sometimes, or maybe knowing what is possible scientifically has sort of moved in the boundaries a bit of what we consider, you know, doable. Like China Mieville and the new weird stuff is brilliant and it's weird and I like it, but it's a different kind of weird. It's still, you know, like, yes, okay, there's icebergs in the sky. Okay, that's odd. Or there are bug-headed women or whatever. Yes, there's a lot of weird, but it's just not so utterly batshit the same way.
Right. Now, did I see right that you studied anthropology?
I did. I have a degree in it for my sins. And as you can see, I am working in my field.
Well, so what was kind of the direction you were looking at when you decided to major in anthropology?
Well, I really liked the Indiana Jones movies, and I thought archaeology was really interesting, and that was sort of the in route roads. If you wanted to study archaeology, you started with an anthropology degree kind of thing, and about maybe two-thirds of the way through it, I was like, I just don't like people that much. This seems like it involves a lot of people. And but at that point, you know, I was most of the way to the degree, so I figured I might as well finish it.
It's so funny how there's like a grouping of degrees in particular that and I include myself as an English major. I definitely include English majors in there. That the degree itself, like, you can go into something very specific for that degree, but oftentimes, maybe most of the time, that degree is just like kind of a generic, yes, I graduated college.
See also my classics minor. And yes, I've... It would have been a double major, except they would have had, I would have had to take a year of either Latin or Greek.
Oof.
And I might have been able to handle Latin, but Greek is really hard. And I'm just not very good with languages. So
same. I did 4 years of Latin in high school, and only because I loved the professor. And it almost killed me because I've always struggled with memorization. Trying to remember anything is terrible. And, you know, that's what all Latin is memorizing vocabulary.
And the problem is I would love to be a person who is good at languages because I think it's super valuable. It's just I'm so bad at it. I've tried, you know, Duolingo and immersion stuff and nothing. Like, after I took 4 years of Japanese, and I remember a couple of the characters and some nouns and one or two swear words, and yeah.
I'm the exact same as you. I just do not, I don't grasp them. I'm not good at just keeping that in my head. My wife is really good at that, and it frustrates the crap out of me, because like, we went to France earlier this year, and we're in Paris. And she immediately picks up on just a few of the little phrases that everybody uses, but she also picks up on the cadence perfectly, to the point where when we walked into a drugstore and she said bonjour to the people, you know, behind the counter, they started talking to her in French and then would look at me and immediately switch to English.
Yep. Yep.
And it's like, how are you able to grasp this so quickly? You know, I like to think I'm good at language because I write for a living, but I'm not, apparently.
No, I think in my case, my hearing's pretty bad. So I think it's like an audio processing thing. I do better with written words. People talk to me, and like half the time in English, I'm like, can you repeat that? but yeah, I went to France with my mother, who had spoke French, high school French, basically. And every single person there that I encountered spoke better English than I spoke French, God knows. And I tried, and every, you know, and basically memorized like three phrases, which were, excuse me, do you speak English? And someone who was there said the best phrase to learn is, excuse me, I have a problem. Can you help me? Because this allows the person you are speaking to feel superior to you, which the French love doing if you are an American, and they will be enormously helpful. I found that true, but they might have been enormously helpful anyway. I don't know.
Because I know when we were prepping to go, it was our first time, and I've heard all of the stereotypes. And honestly, we had a lovely time. I think we had one time when a waiter was very brusque with us, but like otherwise, everybody was super nice. But I guess we were in the touristy places.
Yeah, no, everyone I spoke to was lovely and very helpful. And I don't know if my mother and I just looked like we were completely inept and about to be terribly lost, so people went out of their way to help us or what, but I had, you know, people chasing after us like, no, you're on the wrong platform here, come stand on, oh, okay, thank you. And everyone was lovely. So I've heard that Paris is the one where everyone is rude, but and that even Parisians hate other Parisians, but I don't know if that's true or just a stereotype like about New York. So
right. Well, I think the stereotypes about New York tend to be pretty true.
I have known people who had marvelous experiences in New York and were like, yes, if you understand what being a New Yorker is like, it's, we are all packed together like sardines, so we are all going to pretend each other don't exist so we don't go completely barking mad until the point where we need to recognize you exist. And then they're lovely. But I don't know. It was a very expensive city. That's
Yeah. As someone who did not grow up even near a large city, it was having spent a few different weekends now in a few large cities, it throws me off. Like, how do people sleep with all the noise?
I think it's a skill that you acquire. And I mean, I have read all of the data, and 100% if large cities are usually very eco-friendly in terms of energy consumption and whatnot compared to smaller ones. You share walls, so you know you don't lose heat the same way. You have mass transit. It's marvelous. I just think that a lot of us have not learned the skill of living gracefully in a large city.
Right. I think I've probably spent less than 5 years of my life living somewhere where I share a wall with somebody, which is, you know, partly that's like, you know, as a grown adult, that's like, oh, that's a privilege. I can buy my own house and everything. Obviously, it's great. But like, you know, as a kid, that's just kind of how you are raised and the way that you end up being. And man, I remember the first time I went to Chicago, I was terrified for like 4 days straight. Everything was so fast. It was so big. It was so loud.
I mean, in fairness, driving in Chicago is terrifying, even if it's not your first time. I have basically arranged my life for the last 20 years to avoid ever driving in Chicago again. And so far, it's working out for me.
That's probably a good call.
Hey, Page Break listeners, Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me. So I was curious about, because you have a lot of experience, you do writing, you do art, illustration. I was kind of curious if there is a place creatively that you are the most comfortable.
That's interesting. I really like doing comics because I feel like it's, I don't know if it's if I'm most comfortable there so much as that I feel like people will readers will give you so much emotionally in a with a comic, more so than with a single piece of art or even with a book. Like I've written lots of books, of course, but the engagement you get with a comic is just a whole nother level. I don't know why that is. I love that. That said, drawing a comic is exhausting, and having done an 800-page webcomic, that is a lot, and I don't feel the need to do that again. Having illustrated a lot of children's books, there was a point where I just burned out completely on art, and I'm sort of starting to get back into that. So, I mean, comfort, writing is nice because I can just write that they walked into a cathedral, and if I'm trying to do a comic, I'm like, damn, you passed me, now I have to draw a cathedral. I think writing is easier than having to draw in terms of what you can get away with, but there's just something visceral about comics that I love, and so I keep occasionally wandering back and finding new ways that involve me drawing less.
as somebody with zero artistic skill, I'm always kind of amazed and jealous of people that have the ability to draw, because there's something that when you're writing a big fat epic fantasy novel, you have to craft something, you know, at the very beginning that will engage the reader and pull them in, and you kind of have to hope that you will say something, your characters will do something, or you'll describe the world in a very beautiful way that really speaks to people and pull people in. And it feels like you have to get someone's attention and keep it for like at least a half hour to be able to really get them involved. And something I've always loved as a consumer of art and things like comics and stuff is that I know the moment I glance at a page whether I'm going to be interested in like a comic book or something like that, because art, the way the lines are drawn, the way the characters interact, you know, the framing, all of that stuff, like it's something that like my brain kind of picks up in the blink of an eye and says, that's very pleasing. Now I would like to learn about the story.
Yes.
And it seems so much faster.
I think, like I said, something about the reader buy-in with comics is so immediate and intense, and I don't know why that is, but it is, and I think it's wonderful. I wish I could tap into that for books too. That would be great, but alas, not so much.
Now, something I was wondering about, because you have done both traditional publishing and self-publishing. And I was very curious because, you know, self-publishing in the writing world, as you probably well know, is already a very complicated issue. You know, there's you can talk about the business side with the kind of the race to the bottom in terms of price and all of that stuff. And something I've always kind of wondered about, especially in terms of stuff like web comics, is that there is like this built-in assumption from the consumer, you know, including me at times, where if I want to look at a webcomic, I should be able to pull it up, read the entire backlog at once for free. And that's just a thing. I can do that at my computer. And that's gotta be really, I don't know, is that very frustrating when you're trying to put out like something that that honestly people should be paying money for.
I am not frustrated by it anymore, I suppose, because this is a thing. We went through the sort of the dawn of webcomics, and we worked out a lot of this stuff in like the early 2000s, pretty much. And I was on sites that were subscription only, and that were, you know, the daily is free, but to read the archives, you have to pay us and whatnot. And I remember microtransactions are going to revolutionize webcomics and whatnot. And it turned out virtually none of that was true. And so at the time, I think there were a lot of growing pains, and a lot of people like hitched their wagon to models that turned out not to be viable. The one website I was on, in fact, the creator said to me once, towards the end, he's like, "I'm sorry, you trusted me that this was the way that webcomics were going to work, and it turns out it isn't." And I was like, "I admire that you just flat out admitted that, nope, this business model does not work, and that's okay." It's weird. It wouldn't work for books the same way for whatever reason. Like, if the whole book was free, there are still people who would pay for it, but I think maybe not as many. And I don't know why. With webcomics, there are lots of people who will support you on Patreon usually. There are merch is where all the money is. When I sort of got out of doing webcomics after I finished Digger, I was going, I just don't know if I want to dedicate my life to hauling merch from convention to convention. This seems like maintaining inventory is exhausting. And there are occasionally points where I am like, I could go down this road again and I would become a person who handles merch, or I could do something else.
Well, and I think there are some people, some creators who actually really thrive on having other parts of their business to fiddle with, you know, like merchandise and, you know, running their store and all of that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. There are people who love reading the contracts from the publisher and going through it themselves. And, you know, I am glad those people exist and hope they are extremely happy.
Right. But you're not one of them.
Oh, God, no. No, my agent has a lawyer. My agent reads it. I say, "Tell me what it says." And she says, "This is good. And it says this." And I'm like, "Okay, say yes or say no or whatever."
I've been very lucky that my main income has only come from three different contracts so far in about a 10-year career, give or take. And so I've only really had to read three contracts.
Oof.
And then when it comes to all the foreign stuff, you know, I think I'm around maybe 20 or something like that languages. And all of those, I just leave that to my agent. You know, that's their job. That's what they get their cut for. I'm not going to look at that.
Oh, yeah. When I started doing self-publishing, I was like, told my agent, I am self-publishing. Is that okay? I know this kind of cuts you out of the loop. And she was like, "When they come for the foreign rights, you send it to me and we'll handle it then." And they come for the foreign rights. And I'm like, "Here, yeah, go take, please, whatever they want."
I've had the exact same conversation with my agent of just, "Hey, I want to do this other thing. Are you cool with that?" And she's like, "Yeah, fine. You do your thing and we'll do your other thing." And, you know, the thing that she handles still, you know, encompasses like 85-90% of my income, so she's not threatened too much there.
Oh yeah, and our audiobook rights are, because I know there are self-publishers who want to handle their audiobooks, and again, I admire greatly their willingness to do so. I'm like, they'll pay me money so they can make an audiobook, and then people stop asking me if there's an audiobook. Yes, please, that sounds wonderful.
Well, and I think that that's something that often gets kind of glossed over in the constant fight between the people who really like traditional publishing and the people who really like self-publishing, is that there's so much nuance and so many different ways you can tackle these things that it's fine to be able to say, hey, I really like doing the nitty gritty. I'm going to do it myself versus saying, I don't want to touch that. I'll pay somebody else to do it.
Yeah, I even my self-pub stuff, I have no problem doing the ebooks now. I mean, that was a hard won fight. But when it comes to people are like, can we get a print copy of this? I'm like, oh, Jesus, you can't make me learn InDesign. You cannot make me deal with Ingram. And fortunately, a small press that I knew, I was hanging out with, and I was like, yeah, we were at a convention, actually, in the art show, like at the reception, getting hammered. And I'm like, yeah, I just don't want to deal with it. And they're like, you know, we could do that for you. And I'm all, okay, that sounds amazing. Why don't we do that? Now they handle all of my, you know, print draw versions of my self-pub stuff. And I am delighted they get the money for that because I don't have to deal with it. And it's been lovely.
I had an experience where I was just getting into, I was just really solidifying my career, starting to feel really confident in where I was, and was thinking about doing self-publishing. And I went on vacation up to a friend of mine's parents' lake house. And his parents were there for the weekend, and one of their parents' friends was also there. And that friend said to me, oh, you're a pretty new author. That's so cool. You know that I own a printing business, right? Like a legitimately decent-sized printing business. And he said, if you ever want to come walk through the tour, you just let me know. I'll give you a little tour. And then if you end up ever printing something, we'll print it for you. And so I took him up on the offer. And honestly, the quality of their work was really good. And they pretty much took care of everything. So I started just doing these small batch print runs of the novellas that I write on the side. And to this day, it's like 8 years later. I still just once in a while, I order a batch of novellas from them. There's never an issue. They're always in really good quality. And I'm really pleased to not have to actually like deal with, you know, any of that other junk.
Oh, God. Yeah. The horror stories that you hear. And every now and again, I mean, one slips through. I had someone email me and it's like, so I got a print copy of your book and I'm all okay. And they're like, and it's your book for about 20 pages. And then it's someone else's military sci-fi book. And I'm like, huh,
oops,
let me hook you up with the publisher and the small press. And they're like, yeah, that's a printing error. And we cannot fix that, but we can send you a replacement copy. Yeah, sorry. And you're at the mercy of the guy who's throwing the lever on the machine at the end of the day. So and so many small presses have closed over the years, or small printers rather, that printing is now, you know, a huge problem. Everyone's all, well, you should print this here. And it's, you know, a lot of printing got outsourced to China. And it's a big thing for comics printers is that you can't find one there in the U.S. and occasionally, like, I think there was one in Canada for a while, but it's been a huge problem. And printing is a scary world full of its own problems. Like, there's been a paper shortage for a while, which, good Lord.
Right. And it's one of those things that we totally take for granted. Like I work in an industry that depends upon printing, and I totally take it for granted. You know, like there's something in the back of my brain that says, we've been doing this for centuries. Surely all the kinks have been worked out and there will never be issues. That's not true.
Yeah. Yeah. No, not so much.
So we were talking a little bit about merch and kind of the kind of how you pay your bills as an artist. And I was curious if that still makes up much of your life. The kind of, because I know that, you know, printing books, hand selling things, is that something that you still do at all?
Very little. I before the pandemic, I was still going to conventions fairly regularly, and there was at least one that I would go to every year and sell art because I had been going there basically since the dawn of time, and I was just used to it. And but I was making less and less money at it comparatively, and it was almost like an arms race in getting the new merch that has the stuff that, you know, okay, now this year the hot thing is t-shirts. Okay, now it's keychains. Now it's laser engraved, I don't know, badges and stuff. And after a point, I was just like, I can't keep up with this anymore. And then the pandemic happened and none of us went anywhere for a long time. And then I was like, I just don't want to sell the merch anymore. It wasn't a significant part of my income anymore. And I had outsourced a bunch of my art prints to Potico. Because I was so tired of running prints at home on my, you know, big ink drinking machine and having to go to the post office and whatnot. I was just like, yeah, I make a lot less money on that, but having it outsourced, but it's so much less stress. So yeah, I these days, pretty much all of my money is from books, and Patreon still gives me a fair chunk, but it's almost all books now. So if the book industry ever collapses, I will probably be back at the convention with a tin cup weeping, but
yeah, you and me both. I have no other skills other than making crap up, so
yeah, I am not fit for office jobs any longer. Not that I ever was, but I tried valiantly for a while.
Now, before you went full-time as a creative, what were you doing?
I had the usual succession of weird-ass jobs like that you get out of college. I was a receptionist at a vet for a while. Through college, I was working the night shift at a deli. And the people who will come in at midnight to get thinly sliced head cheese are an unusual breed. And then for a couple of years, I worked at Prudential Insurance, they had a class action lawsuit and they hired a bunch of people to sort it out. So I was just processing claims. And then I was at a streetlight outage hotline, I was in Minneapolis, and when a streetlight goes out, people want to call somebody and tell them the light's out. And I was one of the people who took the call and was like, and where is it? Okay, we'll tell someone. And some very interesting people will call the streetlight outage hotline and inform you that the lights are going off when they walk under them. The FBI is tracing them. I was strictly forbidden to tell them that it was aliens or that it meant they were the Messiah. My boss specifically told me I couldn't do that. And then for a little bit, I worked at a really terrible startup game company. And after it folded, I was like, I guess I have to get another job. Wait, do I have to get another job? And then I was, you know, selling enough art and doing commissions. And it started out mostly as art and then kind of segued into art and writing and then segued harder into writing. So, yeah.
So where, how far into the process of making art and selling it were you when you were able to say, oh, look, I can actually make money off of this?
I was supplementing my income with it pretty soon. It was partly because I draw anthropomorphic animals, and the furries were lovely people, are still lovely people with a huge will support the arts like whoa. So if you take commissions and you can draw foxes, you can make money. So I was making, you know, like it would be like, okay, I'm making like a third of my income from commissions, and then it was sort of half, and then, you know, I start taking more because I'm suddenly unemployed, and oh, look, that's suddenly where all the money is coming from, and okay, it seems to be working. So yeah, and then somewhere in there I sold a book, and sort of accidentally, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, that's very cool though, like being able to take that opportunity and run with it is you know, there's a lot spoken of oh, how do you become an artistic professional, how do you, you know, transition to being full-time. But a lot of that is just seeing the opportunity, getting the timing that for yourself down properly, and just being able to, you know, kind of go whole hog into it.
And it helped that I was at that point young enough that I wasn't panicked that I didn't have health insurance for quite a while, kind of thing. And I was married, and then I was divorced, and then I realized that I had actually been making a lot of the money for a while, and so that didn't go so badly. But there was a lot of it's feast or famine. You know, you're always very close to the edge when you're creative, and so the books were amazing because all of a sudden they were. I was happy to make $800 in a month and cover rent, and the books are like, here is your $15,000 advance, and I'm like, really? That seems like a huge amount of money.
My first contract for my Powder Mage books was, I think, the contract, and of course, over three books, over three big epic fantasies. That's still many years, but I think it was about six or seven times what I had made the previous year.
Yep.
And I just went, oh, I'm quitting my job because my job sucks. I'm making $12 an hour. And suddenly, bam, I've got a career. But then the panic sets in of, oh, wait, I have a career. I've got to actually treat it like a career and keep writing.
Oh, yeah. I was lucky in that because I had been doing art commissions and whatnot, and the commissions were tied to the money, that I did not feel unemployed, basically, when I was no longer working at a company. And but yeah, there's that I didn't have to like reshuffle my entire mentality to when I started getting advances for writing. But I know a lot of people, it's like a complete culture shock.
Yeah. And it's a culture shock in a lot of ways, you know, one of those being that you suddenly don't have anybody looking over your shoulder. You know, there's some kind of creative professions where you, even if you're a freelancer, you know, you're talking to the people paying you on a regular basis.
Yeah, the art director is still, you know, checking in and being like, well, I have this at the end of the week. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you're like writing, especially with novels, like I talk to my editor like three times a year.
Yep.
So I am so not accountable. And it can be really hard to deal with that.
Yeah, like occasionally I'm like, if I just didn't write anything, no one would ask until November when the book is due. And so it's basically my own horrible fear of disappointing people that motivates me. So, you know, oh, God, if I miss the deadline, something will explode. But yeah, if I didn't have the crippling anxiety, then God knows what would happen.
Yeah. I definitely feel horrible guilt when I miss a deadline, and I've learned kind of how to talk to my editor and my agent about these things. Like early on, like I would just clam up and I wouldn't say anything at all until suddenly the deadline was there and they're asking for a thing, and I'm panicked and trying to, you know, make up excuses. And thankfully I've done this long enough that if I can see a deadline, missing a deadline from a ways out now,
yep,
and can just say, hey, this isn't going to happen. Let's reschedule for a few months away and we'll talk about it.
Yeah. And I've generally found that as long as you're like, and my editor's always been great with, if I'm like, hey, X happened, I'm not going to make this. Can I get another month? It's rarely a problem. And usually they're like, you know, yeah, the absolute final must-have date is, in fact, Y. And I'm like, okay, I can definitely make it by Y. And usually, as long as we're all talking, it's not a problem. Occasionally, I will send, like, a sort of state of the Ursula address, which is, I'm currently at X point on this, I'm working on the edits for this, this other, you know, the other thing you bought, here's my idea. And everything's on track. So, yeah, just want to let you know that things are going well. They don't necessarily need that, but it makes me feel better to send it.
Well, and with these kind of loose business kind of partnerships where you have a contract, obviously, and you are working together, but you don't spend a lot of time on that work together. I think it's really important to have clear communication.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It took me a while to discover that it was okay to say, okay, I tried writing this book that we had talked about me writing, and it is not working. Can we come up with another idea? Because, which took a while until, you know, the point where I was selling books, where I was just selling them five books, say, instead of this particular book in front of me, and you bought that book in particular. No, you bought five books. And so then we'll be like, okay, what should book three be? Okay, well, I had this idea. All right, great, write that. And then I'll be like, no, wait, that idea sucked. And it just wasn't coming together. And now I can be like, can we come up with another idea? And they've always been great about brainstorming and helping me come up with another idea. So.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that's actually something that really fascinates me, because I know a few different authors who have created that sort of relationship with publishers where they sell them books. They don't sell them a particular book. They sell them books. And so they've got that under contract that they'll write them a book that's roughly this number of words in roughly this genre. But beyond that, it's kind of in development. And that does that not stress you out like crazy?
It can. When I tour, when I first contracted with them, what happened actually is I had a novella lying around. And novellas, as I'm sure you know, are what do you do with a novella? And so what I had been doing was basically doing collections of short stories and using a novella as sort of an anchor on that. But I was like, wait, Tor has an open submission for novellas thing. They're publishing novellas. I should send them one. And then like about 6 hours later, I was like, wait, I have an agent. I don't have to wait for the open submission period. And so I go to my agent. I'm like, can you send them one of these? And my agent's like, yes, you have an agent. That's what I do. So she sends them a novella, and they come back and are all, yes, we like this novella very much. We would like that. And we would also like two novels and another novella, if that's okay with you. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Sounds good. But then, and it was again, the practically sight unseen thing. They were all, yes, we will buy this particular novella. And then actually it was three novels for that one. It was one novella, three novels. They're like, so give us, you know, three more novels as well. And I agreed. And then it was the way I write is that I will start something. I will write 10, 15,000 words. And then I will usually send it to my agent with like, see if you can find somebody to pay me to finish this. I do not outline. Outlines are an instrument of torture. The end of one of these 15,000 words is usually like a paragraph synopsis. That's like, this happens. And there's a really cool scene here and the goodbye guys win and everyone lives happily ever after. And it's often just about that level of quality. And so my editor at Tor, Lindsay Hall, and I were going back and forth for like a month where I would just, I emptied out my hard drive of all of the books I had started and was just sending them to her and going, you like this one? How about this one? What do you think of this one? And some of them, she was like, I like this. This is going somewhere. I want to see more. Some of them, she's like, no, this isn't working. At least one, she was like, let's put a pin in this one, which I have since learned is there is no way in hell we are publishing a book that starts with there is literally a dead baby in the first sentence.
Jeez.
But it was all about changelings, and there were changelings everywhere in the city, and the mother who's the hero is like, is not sure if she has postpartum psychosis or if she's actually seeing that all of these infants have been replaced with changelings all over town. And so it's this really, it's messed up, I admit. Someday I will write that book. But yeah, she wanted to put a pin in that one. She said it was a little too sad for that. And I'm like, and okay, yeah, I understand that. That is specialized fare. But God, it would be so good though. And finally, like, I was hitting the dregs, and I said to her, when I was like, this is completely a Hail Mary pass, but what do you think of this one? She's like, I love that one. Write that one. And that was Nettle and Bone, which came out a couple of months ago. And I'm like, oh, yay. But yeah, it can be very stressful. Or she had, or another one they bought, and they were like, we love this book, but this can't be the first book we publish by you, because the heroine is, it starts as, the heroine is like 16 at the time the adventures happen, so it's going to read as YA, even though it's not a YA book. And once you get pigeonholed as a YA author, it's impossible to drag you back out, particularly if you have a female author name. So we would like this to be like the second or third book by you we publish. And I'm like, that is totally legit. I respect that. But now I have to write two more books, kind of thing. So yeah, it can be very stressful. I later had a Nightfire, the horror publisher, Tor Nightfire, did the same kind of deal where they're like, we really want your stuff. We will buy two novellas and two novels from you. And so the second novel is the one most recently where I was like, yeah, this thing I thought was going to work is just not working. I have this other horrible idea. And they were like, yeah, we like that horrible idea. You should write something like that. At one point, I was watching Midsommar on and tweeting about it, and they were like, do you think you could write a horror novel based on Midsommar? We were enjoying your tweets. And I'm like, let me think. No. I would love to, but no, it turns out that one's just not going to gel. I gave it a try, but no.
Do you find that you enjoy writing for a younger audience or an older audience more?
I enjoy writing for an older audience more. This is one of those weird things when I am good at writing for kids, but I don't enjoy it as much. There were a lot of I wrote a bunch of kids books. My first published books were all for kids, and I wrote let me think something like 18 kids books in remarkably short order. I sold the first one in 2008, and I think the last one came out in like 2018 or something. It was so, yeah, like 18 books in 10 years, which that'll take it out of you a bit. And there were my voice, the sort of authorial voice worked great for writing for kids, but because I sound the same no matter what age range I'm writing for, as it turns out. But my editor kept being like, you can't do this in a children's book. No, you are not allowed to burn the castle down at the end of the book. We do not teach children that arson solves their problems. And I'm like, arson solves a lot of problems, though. And I joke that every children's book author is a frustrated horror writer, because every time they tell you you cannot do a thing in a book, it lodges in your chest and just compresses until it is like diamond. And finally you erupt with, I am going to write a book for grownups, and I am going to put every goddamn messed up thing I have ever thought of in there, and no one will stop me. And so yes, the horror novels did very well. And yeah.
Do you look at your fiction as an outlet for kind of, you know, something inside of you?
I don't. That's the funny thing. Other than the, you know, my editor told me I couldn't do this bit. like a lot of horror authors or a lot of authors show will be like, yes, you know, I have this inner darkness and I release it on the page. And I don't have any inner darkness. I am basically the same all the way through. But I do come up with many things that seem very logical to me, I am told by my editors, kind of horrific. And so, like, an example, a fantasy novel that came out a year or two ago called Paladin's Grace, or no, Paladin's Strength was this one. And a throwaway set of characters were, I was like, rabbits would be a great hive mind. You know, if they, because they live in a warren, they're communal, so we'll just make them a hive mind. That's great. And that was fine. But then I was like, okay, if the rabbits need to communicate with humans, and they would need like a speaker. Okay. Now, but rabbit throats aren't like designed to make human speech. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that. So they would need to like grow a specific speaker rabbit who has all of these alterations made to like their tongue and palate and throat. And okay, but that's going to make them a really top-heavy, weird rabbit. And they're going to sound horrifying. But still, that's what would happen. So there's a scene in my nice little fantasy romance where the rabbits, basically the hive mind rabbits, drag one of their number out who has this massively sort of goitered throat and who begins squealing, you know, in this kind of dying rabbit shriek that, and speaking English or, you know, whatever language they are, and all the humans are like, oh, no, nope, nope, that is messed up. But it was all entirely logical and followed logically. and lots of readers have told me that was really, really kind of messed up. And I'm like, but it obviously this is how it would work if you had to have a sentient rabbit hive mind that wanted to communicate with people. And yeah, so... No, my husband does, who is my beta reader of all of my books, will get to points in horror and be like, what is wrong with you? And I'm just glad it's out on the page and not fermenting inside your brain.
See, I'm always trying to look for shortcuts and things. So like, you know, the rabbit communicating problem, I just be, oh, magic, it's fine. That's all I'm going to explain.
Yeah, I mean, that would work, but it obviously must have been magic that allowed them to evolve a rabbit that could do that. It was, you know, I was just like, let me meet the magic halfway there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and everybody kind of approaches that sort of creative, how am I going to solve narrative problems? Everybody approaches that differently.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you, it's like the joke about people stealing ideas. If you give one idea to 10 writers, you get 12 different versions back.
Right. Like the biggest artistic thief in the world is Bob Dylan. It's the guy who everybody now emulates. He stole all of his crap from, you know, everything that came before him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or, you know, fairy tale retellings. Like, none of us invented Beauty and the Beast. Although, incidentally, if you read like the sort of original document of Beauty and the Beast, as far as we can tell, it is a 17th century French fairy tale, and it is like 150 pages long. And Beauty and the Beast is the first like third, and then all the rest is fairy cult court politics. It is really bizarre and sort of. One of the key factors that threw me is that for some reason Beauty has monkey butlers in that version.
Well, and we're coming full circle to some of the crap that was written a while back was so weird.
Oh God, yes, the mouse, the bird, and the sausage, the fairy tale. If you've ever seen it, it's a fairy tale, and one of the characters is a talking sausage, and she's the cook, and she cooks by slithering around in the frying pan to season the food with her like juices. And it's, I'm like, okay, talking sausage. That's kind of what?
It's so strange.
Yep.
Well, I have been keeping you for quite a while now, but we like to wrap up every episode by asking a bit of a left field question for every guest, which is, what is the last thing that you ate that blew your mind?
Oh, the last thing I ate that blew my mind. I was at the coast, and they had this tuna tartar tower, and it was raw tuna and avocado and kind of like a very chunky guacamole, and this it was almost like an eel sauce kind of glaze over it. It was freaking amazing, and not anything I could ever replicate at home, but because I like it was stacked like little rings on this tower, and I don't know what the glaze was, but it was amazing.
So okay, I'm always a little bit, I'm always thrown when people eat raw meat. Is it not? Does it not kind of squeak you out a little bit?
No, raw fish does not bother me at all. Like red meat, yeah, that weirds me out. But raw fish, I can't eat cooked fish. Cooked fish, like, it just tastes really fishy. But I will devour sushi all day long. I can do raw fish, but not. Yeah.
When we were in Paris, my publicist kind of wandered around, did some touristy stuff with us, and was really a great host, really awesome. But she ate beef tartare for every single meal. And it just,
damn,
it really threw me off.
My husband would absolutely eat beef tartare. I won't go that far. Red meat wigs me out. But fish doesn't bother me.
Oh, that's funny. Because I grew up in a household where my dad loved getting beef rare, but my mom refused to cook anything rare. She cooked everything, I won't say to death, but pretty close to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whenever we were at a restaurant, my dad would order veal or order a steak with, you know, like rare. But everything we ate at home was like very cooked. And so I got used to that texture. And I was probably 30 or so before I could really eat medium rare beef. And I still can't eat rare. It's just a little too much for me.
It has to be at least hot in the middle. Like, I don't mind pink, but if I get the impression that a good vet could get it up and around, that's not gonna work for me.
Oh, that's perfect.
That was writer and artist Ursula Vernon. Thanks again to Ursula for taking the time to chat. You can find links to Ursula's social media down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. If you're listening to this via Patreon, please stick around for bonus chat during the epilogue. Special thanks to Elijah, Ivor Gullickson, James Clark, Jennifer Johnson, Jay Sunnell, Kyle Anderson, Sexton Hardcastle, and Talon for their backing on Patreon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.